This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hello, I'm joined with Professor Philippa Browning from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. And we're going to talk a bit about your career, Philippa.
Hi.
Hi. So what sort of stuff are you currently researching here?
Okay, well, I'm interested particularly in the corona of the sun. So that's the outer atmosphere of the sun that from the Earth you normally only see at a total eclipse. But we have lots of data about the corona, particularly from space telescopes. It turns out one of the interesting things about the corona is the temperature of the corona is about a million degrees or more. And that's very surprising when you take into account that the temperature on the surface of the sun, the photosphere, is only 6,000 degrees. So it means basically the sun, if you like, is hot in the middle. It's actually about 15 million degrees. As you would expect, it gets cooler as you come towards the surface. But then you go out into the atmosphere and it starts getting hotter again. And that is obviously not what you'd expect. So one of the things that my research is concerned with is trying to explain that. And I say we have a lot of new data from telescopes in space. So we know a lot more observationally what's going on. But what I'm trying to do is develop theories to really explain that.
That's one of the problems with solar research, isn't it? Because the sun is so easy to observe relatively compared to other astrophysical objects. We've got so much information on it that it's quite difficult to develop a theory that encompasses all of those observational details.
Yes, that's right. We have a lot of, when you look at a star, you tend to see it more or less as a point, and you get really just its very much overall properties. But we can see, for example, the corona in a vast amount of detail, and we can see it's got all sorts of fine structure, very detailed, lots of loops. And different, some regions are hotter than others, some regions are brighter than others. So very complex structure, also very much changing in time as well. So, you know, bright regions sort of come and go and change. And so trying to develop a model for that is very challenging. As is one way of looking at it, because we get more data, which is great. But every time you learn more, you have more to explain, basically. Yeah, you can't just make up a theory and
sure.
Say that's it. You've also got to actually fit the data which
yeah.
is there.
Yeah.
So it's putting those things together is a bit of a challenge, yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I know.
Yes.
Yeah. So what are the candidates for explaining that unexpectedly hot corona?
Right. Well, the one thing I think more or less everyone is agreed about is it's something to do with the magnetic field. And we know the corona has a very strong magnetic field. Well, strong in the sense that the magnetic forces are much bigger than any other forces. So if you think you've got the force of gravity, just like in any atmosphere, you know, things are being pulled downwards. You've got the force of pressure, just as you have in the Earth's atmosphere. Basically, it's sort of pressure differences that give you sort of winds and so on in the Earth's atmosphere. And those forces, of course, are there in the corona. But we have also this magnetic force, which is very much stronger. So it's really the magnetic field, which is sort of controlling everything. And we think the coronal heating is to do with getting energy sort of out of the magnetic field and converting it into heat. But there, within that, there are then basically two competing camps. One idea is it's to do with waves. So you imagine taking the ends of the magnetic field line, a bit like just taking hold of one end of a piece of string and shaking it, and you will get waves moving along the string. So we get waves moving along the magnetic field lines. And those waves are carrying energy, and that energy, in principle, can then be converted into heat. The other idea is that we build up what we call some DC, or steady magnetic energy, in the corona. So there it's more, again, perhaps thinking of the magnetic field lines as being rubber bands. If you just slowly stretch a rubber band, you're putting energy into that. And if you were to sort of let it go, it could snap or whatever. So you're getting energy as you just basically stretch or distort the magnetic field lines. And there, a lot of the energy is associated with the fact that the fields can be quite tangled or twisted or whatever. Again, like a bunch of string, you could turn the strings and twist it. You could tangle them up into a big mess. And whenever you do that, you basically got energy there. And we can get that energy out into heat as well.
Right.
So those are the sort of two competing theories, basically.
Okay. Which one's right?
Nobody knows would be the simple answer, although of course a lot of people think they know. But I think in terms of explaining the heating of what we call loops, which are the regions where the magnetic field basically comes sort of out of the surface of the sun and goes back in again, and those are actually the hottest plasma and really have the, if like where the coronal heating problem is most acute, because you need most heating. It looks like, in terms of explaining the heating of those sort of structures, that the steady magnetic fields, the DC mechanism, is the strongest contender.
Okay.
Whereas waves might be more appropriate, where you have regions where, for example, the magnetic field is open and just sort of connects out into space, and the waves sort of propagate up and into space. But of course, in practice, it may be a combination of the two. We like to sort of divide things into nice categories, as though you've got, one or the other. And as we've said, the corona is very complicated, so it's almost certain that sort of both things are going on. And it's more a question of, which is playing the biggest role, and, is the answer like somewhere in the middle, basically.
So you mentioned there that it was regions of hot plasma. Are you interested in plasma physics by itself as well as solar physics? And what about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the interesting things about the corona is that we have this interaction of the magnetic field with the plasma or very hot gas. And that is going on in a lot of other places in the universe, but also in a lot of places on Earth as well. And one example of that is we've got the idea of trying to do fusion on Earth, trying to get energy from fusion, which is actually the same way the sun gets its energy. The sun does it already, but it would be nice to do it on Earth as well, and we could actually, generate electricity. So there, again, you have to have a plasma, a very hot gas. It turns out you need very high temperatures to make fusion work, and you can't just put that into some sort of container. So the trick is to use a magnetic field to confine the plasma. And the idea is you would make a sort of magnetic bottle and use the magnetic field to, say, confine the plasma and then get your fusion to give you your energy. So the processes are really very much the same as what's going on in the solar corona. And in fact, the conditions in many ways are quite comparable. The sort of, the temperatures are quite similar and so on. So it's a sort of two-way process. If we study the corona, we learn more about plasma physics and magnetic fields, and we can apply that to these magnetically confined fusion plasmas, and obviously the other way around as well. So one field can very much learn from another, and that's something. So I have also done work on magnetically confined fusion plasmas, again, trying to basically develop theoretical models of how they behave.
Okay. So how long is it before we have nuclear fusion on Earth till we can not worry about energy anymore?
That's the big question. Things are making considerable progress, and they are currently well on the way to building what's called ITER, which is a big tokamak kind of experimental reactor in the south of France that should really demonstrate the feasibility of fusion power, but won't yet be an actual reactor. It certainly won't generate any electricity. It's not designed to do that. It's just designed to demonstrate the processes. So that's well underway now, and hopefully after that we could start on actually building a demonstration fusion reactor. So people say by about the middle of the century we could at least have a sort of working electricity demonstration. If not an actual, you might not necessarily be getting your electricity from that process yet,
but
it will be
the classic 30 to 40 years from now.
That seems to be about it, yes. But I think now we've actually got a much clearer view of what the steps are to get from where we are to where we want to be.
Sure.
But there are lots of problems. There's obviously, potentially scientific problems. There's still to be overcome. There's engineering problems. And there's also sort of political problems, actually, getting people to sort of pay for it and
work together and so on. Yeah, I heard there was a bit of difficulty with the American Congress recently.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they're having a sort of review of their participation. And it's very difficult getting a lot of teams from really virtually all over the world to work together on one big project.
True.
That takes an awful lot of coordination, and
it's enormously expensive as well, so
it is, but not compared with a lot of other things.
Okay.
You spend money on.
Fair enough. That's true.
Yeah, if you think of the potential benefits, it's actually, in some sense not that expensive, I think.
So what do you think we have to look forward to over the next, well, in the near future, in terms of solar physics?
Well, in terms of solar physics, the exciting thing coming up on the observational side is Solar Orbiter, which I think is hopefully going to be launched in 2018. And Solar Orbiter is going to go basically really close to the sun, about a sort of, well, almost a fifth of the distance from the sun that the Earth is. So pretty close. And so it's going to be sitting in the solar wind very close to the sun and basically picking up the stuff as it comes out of the sun and measuring it directly. But at the same time, it's going to be looking at the sun with telescopes and looking at the surface of the sun. So we'll be getting that kind of connection between what's happening in the low corona very close to the surface of the sun and what's coming sort of further out as you get close to the Earth, and be able to sort of directly link those things together.
Okay.
So you will, for example, see some kind of, you know, event like a flare or something near the surface of the sun. You'll sort of watch that going on, and then all the particles from that will sort of propagate outwards, and then they'll, you know, you'll be at the spacecraft and just basically watch them go by and measure their properties.
Wow, okay.
So you can sort of make the connection and gradually start to link things together. So that's obviously a very exciting mission. No, we've never done that. We've never gone that close to the sun before. Usually we're looking at it from spacecraft, which are really very near the Earth, at the sort of same distance from the sun as the Earth is.
Yeah.
And the other thing also Solar Orbiter will do is it will basically fly out of the ecliptic plane. So the Earth is always going in, you know, an orbit, which is effectively more or less around the equator of the sun. So we're only, you know, we're sort of basically seeing the sun from one angle, and it's very difficult to sort of know what's going on near the poles of the sun. So Solar Orbiter will sort of fly out of the ecliptic, so it'll be basically looking down at the sun from the top and from the bottom, if that makes sense. So
okay.
We'll be seeing the sort of top and the bottom of the sun, as
right.
well as the sides of it.
Yeah.
And that's very important in terms of understanding the magnetic field.
Yeah.
And if you think even of, say, the magnetic field of the Earth, you know, there's like a magnetic north pole and a magnetic south pole. And so if you want to understand the Earth's magnetic field, if you don't know what's going on near the poles, it's like you're never going to understand it. So we really have to sort of understand those polar regions of the sun and know what's going on there to understand sort of how the magnetic field is working. And again, obviously from the Earth, we're, you know, we're kind of trapped where we are. We can only look at it from one perspective.
Yeah, sure.
So this will give us something quite different. So I think that's the thing to watch out for, Solar Orbiter.
Okay. And when's that coming online?
Well, I say it should be launched in 2018. But it will take it a while. It has to go by a rather circuitous route to get to the sun. It's actually surprisingly, you can't just send something directly towards the sun because of the fact that it's, you're already in, got the orbital motion of the Earth. So you have to swing round, I think it's Jupiter, to get back. So it'll take it a while, but it will start doing stuff on the way as well, I think.
Okay.
And I think it'll be in about the 2020s when we start getting the really interesting data back.
All right. Well, before we go, actually, you told me something interesting recently about some outreach events that you were doing. Just wondered if you wanted to give a quick shout out to them.
Yeah, there's something very different. I just got a little bit involved with an event involving dance and the life cycle of stars. So it will be involving a few schools and colleges from Manchester who are going to be learning different dances, which will be related to how stars are born. And that actually also involves another of our colleagues, Rowan Smith from Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics, and then moving on how sort of stars, you know, stars become, well, our sun is obviously just a star. So it will be, you know, teaching children then about our sun and trying to understand the fact that the sun is a star and how it behaves. So they will learn about flares and magnetic fields and also how important the sun is for the Earth. But I say they will be doing that through actually developing dances, which is obviously very unusual.
Yeah.
But you can sort of imagine it, there's a lot of twisting and sort of coming together and passing on energy and all that.
Yeah.
So I think that's a very exciting way for children to learn about science.
Yeah.
And
it's very inventive.
Yeah, and I'm sure it will stick in their minds in a way that perhaps a science lesson in the conventional way wouldn't. So.
Well, hopefully. Okay, so there we have it, interpretive dance and solar physics.
Yes.
All right, well, thank you very much, Professor Philippa Browning. I guess we'll speak to you next time.
Yeah, thank you very much. Bye.